Do you want it or do you not? It's up to you. You tell me.
I can use this, right? This is fine.
Yes, sir.
And if that breaks down, I'll just scream. Okay. I'm going to go about, I've been told to speak about 25 minutes and then take some questions. And then you'll go on with the rest of the evening. My daughter's here with me, my technical support here. She's also getting dual credit between Baylor and her sixth grade class. You've heard of AP credit. How about middle school dual credit? Okay. I want to say a little bit about Fujimura, and I want to show you some images of some of his paintings because you get those a little bit in the book. We'll have an exhibition of his art in the Martin Art Gallery, which you'll know how to find by the time those paintings arrive here in October. And they'll be here about a month, from mid-October to mid-November. And he'll be here November 11th and 12th for a conference where he'll be speaking, and all of you will be in attendance at that, we hope, right? That's the plan, for to be there. He's a really remarkable guy. He's a Japanese-American, born in Boston, and educated at Bucknell, and a painter of some success and renown. There's the Dylan Gallery, both in Chelsea, in Manhattan, and in Tokyo. His artwork is sold there, and he's a convert to the Christian faith, and someone who, after his conversion, began to take very seriously the question of art and religious faith. So I want to talk a little bit about his vision and his way of seeing things, but I want to start with a short clip from 9/11, because much of his work since the September 11th attacks has been, you won't see it reflected in his art. He's got it's a remarkably sort of joyful art, and these paintings you have to imagine as being huge in scope. They're quite remarkable. But his work in thinking about art and his attempt to build a community of artists in Tribeca in New York City was really sort of spurred by the 9/11 attacks. His studio and his apartment and his kids' school were within blocks of Ground Zero. And in fact, they had to move out of their apartment. One of his children was nearly killed by falling debris. If he had walked out of the school just a few moments earlier, he probably would not have lived. So a lot of his thinking about art has been framed by this catastrophic event in New York City. So one of the questions that he's been raising concerns how we make sense out of things like this, how we make sense out of cataclysmic acts of destruction and indeed of evil, and how we begin to talk about art. There's a lot of talk after 9/11. I don't know if any of you remember 9/11. How many of you remember that? Wow, okay. Good. That's something in the cultural memory. Very good. You're not just remembering clips that you've seen since then, but you actually remember watching TV when it happened. I do too. She was in a baby car seat in the back of our car as we were in the suburbs of Boston driving back in the morning from Starbucks, my wife and me, and hearing these reports and then getting back to the house to watch all of this on TV, and then walking outside in Boston at about noon and the oddest feeling that there were no planes anywhere to be seen. Just complete quiet. And utter just those crystal clear blue skies. That's one of the things I remember about that day. This is just a short clip, and I want to play this, and then we'll look at some images and talk about his art in light of this.
And this was a similar situation. This defies belief to think that this symbol of New York City actually collapsing before our eyes, and the humanities involved in all this, the thousands of people who were at work. Remember when that B-25 fire that you mentioned hit the building, it was on a weekend. There was virtually nobody in the Empire State Building. So there were very, very few casualties. But this is a work day.
Okay, it doesn't take much to remember and to start to recall the horrors of that day and the weeks immediately after it. The studio near Ground Zero, He was trapped in the subway beneath the debris. And then there's this. You could say we were too close to know what was going on, Mr. Fujimura recalled. Above ground swirled a gray storm of ash with stricken, blood-smattered New Yorkers rushing past him. There were 8,000 kids around the towers at the time of the attacks, and I didn't know where mine was. He found CJ, his oldest child, first. Mrs. Fujimura managed to locate the couple's other two children, safe and reunited. Mr. Fujimura and his family found themselves homeless. The collapse of the tower shook their own building. Exploded glass created a gas leak and filled the block with debris. They would not go home again until December. And then this is create, we must, and respond to this dark hour. The world needs artists who dedicate themselves to communicate the images of shalom. Jesus is the shalom. Tribeca Temporary grew from that seed, a ground zero tea house and a community space for artists displaced by the attacks. With fellow painter Hiroshi Senju, Mr. Fujimura turned a studio into a place for restoration and healing from spiritual as well as artistic losses, where Mr. Fujimura said beauty too is defined as a participant in the suffering of the world. Okay. A horrifying day. You can think about art with respect, I'm going to have to stay close to this, sorry. You can think about art with respect to 9/11 in a number of ways. Some of them actually fairly horrifying. There is, this first one is not, certainly. You can think of the art that went into the composition and construction of the Twin Towers themselves and of that community, these magnificent structures. You can also think, and this part is horrifying, there was a German artist not long, in the days immediately after 9/11, I was asked to contribute something on how we think about evil after an event like this to the Chronicle of Higher Ed. And there was a quote from a German artist who said that this was a magnificent piece of art, this destruction. Now, you probably have to be as far away as Germany, if not further, to think of what happened there as a work of art. But I don't know if you recall seeing clips of Osama bin Laden that were circulated not long after that, of him making the images of the thing blowing up, and I don't know what he was saying. I don't know whether to trust the translation, but it was something like, it was beautiful. Right? Is there any reason to say that? Well, can you say that evil or that massive destruction and intentional killing of the innocent is beautiful? I would say no, but it has some similarities to the strong experience of beauty. There's something astonishing, something of great magnitude, something that is in a sense awe-inspiring, even if horrifying at the same time. These are the same passions in us that great art calls forth from our soul. Some sense of the awesomeness, the fearfulness even, of the imagery. There's also, and you'll recall if you read these essays carefully, which I'm sure you all did, that Fujimura at one point talks about the terrorist art, their art. Right? And there are arts that can be destructive, but nonetheless enticing in a way, right? There are dark arts that attract us and draw us in. And certainly these images are almost impossible to put out of your imagination once you've seen them. The really wonderful thing about the images that we saw in the couple weeks after the 9/11 attacks were the images, and Fujimura also talks about this, of the rescuers, right? Of all the people who risked their own lives, many of them lost their lives, police and firemen rushing into buildings as they're collapsing, right? There is, and one could talk about, and Fujimura does, about the beauty of that sort of sacrifice. What's rational about being a police officer or a fireman in New York City when you know that you might face, well, no one could have anticipated facing something like this, but what's rational about living in such a way that you're willing to take very little pay, to risk your life when other people are running away, right? There's a great, the Newseum, you know this place in D.C.? This museum devoted to the news. There's a big section devoted to 9/11. And there's a quote from Rod Dreher, who's a friend of some of ours here, he used to work for the Dallas Morning News as a journalist, and he was actually working for the New York Post on the day that the 9/11 attacks occurred, And he was about to go back over the bridge into Brooklyn when this happened to see his wife and child. And he turned around and headed with his notepad in hand directly toward the attacks. And there's a line on the wall of the museum that says, "Most people flee from danger. Police, firemen, and journalists run toward it." Right? There's nothing rational about that. And yet there's something beautiful about it. And that, I think, is one of the traits of great beauty, that it exceeds our capacity to calculate that this was worth it. It's something excessive, right? Something, we might say, gratuitous, not in the pejorative sense of that term, where we say that was a gratuitous remark, but something that has the character of a gift about it, right? An offering. And Fujimori is very much connected to this. How do we think about art in light of horror, in light of evil, in light of destruction? Right? This has happened numerous times in the 20th and now in the early 21st century, especially with the Holocaust, right? How can you think about art after the Holocaust? How do you make movies about the Holocaust? Every time there's a serious movie made about the Holocaust, and there have been a lot of very good ones made, there's a debate about whether the art helps us to see and feel and understand better what happened, or whether it messes it up and detracts from it, right? So when we're talking about very serious events, historical events, events of great magnitude, events of great destruction, and events where great evil has been perpetrated and innocent people have been killed, we take that art very seriously, right? So there are movies made about 9/11. There's a couple quite good movies made that capture a lot of the sacrifices that were made at Ground Zero and elsewhere in 9/11. These are films where art is attempting to both take us into Ground Zero, take us into the horror of these events, but then show us something more. Fujimori is very interested, as you can tell from reading these essays, about the sort of sad state of art in much of the professional art world. In fact, you may have had the experience of going to very contemporary art exhibitions and not being able to make any sense out of any of it. Right, looking at what are called paintings, looking at what are called sculptures, and wondering, why is this art? Is it art? Well, Fujimori is concerned that when we get to the point where we don't even know how to use the word, we're in trouble. And there's a certain sustenance in the soul, which needs beauty, that's not being fed. So he talks about this kind of theoretical skepticism with respect to art. He quotes somebody from an art school who says, art can't be taught. It can't be taught. It just has to be done. Well, if it can't be taught, and there's a kind of skepticism behind this about how we define art, how we talk about it, Fujimori thinks we've got problems, right? So you might say, I remember when I was in Boston being at a party where there was a poet there, and I'm using that term very loosely, who made poems out of every third word of famous documents, like taking the Declaration of Independence. And taking every third word, that's a poem, right? Our computers weren't as advanced then, but you could write a lot of poetry now. That's all you were going to do, right? Every third word or every first word, whatever you want it to be. Well, you really don't want to argue with somebody about that, about whether it's art. But you do want to ask, well, okay, but why should anybody take this seriously? Right? If you want to call that art, fine. Just don't bother me with it. Right? Go off and do that. There's a kind of trade-off in this, a sort of sleight of hand in this, in some of these claims that, well, it's art because I call it art. Well, fine, if you want to do that, but you also seem to want the authority and reverence that we've accorded to artists traditionally who produce great objects of beauty. You want us to take you seriously the way we took them seriously, right? But we took them seriously because we could all gradually come to understand that their art was beautiful. We might not have been able to do it initially. I'm not saying that every artwork we approach, we ought to be able to say immediately, ah, that's beautiful. Sometimes art's difficult. Sometimes poetry's difficult. Right? Reading James Joyce, T.S. Eliot, that's difficult. But they're great works of art. Right? The question is whether the art repays your effort to come to understand it. You might say, well, I spent a lot of time trying to understand that. I now do. I wasted my time. Right? Great art, like great literature, great music, should repay your time and effort. It can be difficult, but you want to get something out of the effort that you're putting into it. There's also this notion, and Fujimura actually responds to that skepticism as he's walking. He was thinking about this and walking. He's thinking about the light. I have to trust the light to see. I can't have skepticism about the object of sight or about light. And the artist, him or herself, also has to trust that there's a light that is beauty that can be seen and can be reproduced. The other sort of standard view of art, which is connected to that first one, is art as negative or as subversive, right? There's a strong movement in the 20th century that not only says that art ought to put into question decadent customs or ugly practices, but that art by definition is supposed to offend us. Right? You sometimes hear about this when you read that the National Endowment for the Arts has funded somebody who's got, excuse this, but you probably saw it, like the Piss Christ image, right? Where you've got a crucifix in a bucket of urine. Right? This was a famous work of art in a museum a few years back. And you want to say, well, the first thing you want to say is, I wish I weren't paying for that, right? But the next thing you want to say is, well, is that art? Right? Is it art merely because it offends? It doesn't take all that much creative talent simply to offend, but there's a strong movement in 20th century art to say art, by definition, offends. There's also a view of the artist as a sort of isolated individual. This actually dates back to the Romantic period of the 19th century, and where art's only purpose is a kind of self-expression. Right? Gombrich is a great historian of art, works his way up from ancient Egypt all the way to the 19th century, and says, at last, art becomes about self-expression. The reason it becomes about self-expression is because it's lost every other purpose. It's lost its communal purpose, it's lost its political purpose, it's lost its religious purpose. Right? Now, what I'm saying now is not, I'm not denying that art is about self-expression. I'm saying if that's all art is about, you're likely not to produce great art. Fujimura, in that one section where he goes to see the 500-year question essay, where he goes to the Met to see this exhibition of Fra Angelico's art, and he walks in front of the first Madonna image that he sees that Fra Angelico painted more than 500 years ago, he almost breaks down. He's not a real emotional guy, but he almost breaks down and he has to leave. And he has to leave because he's wondering what has become of his own art. What's become of art in the late 20th century, that not only will it not be the case that his art or any of his colleagues' art is being looked at 500 years from now, except by some chance, but no one even thinks it possible or aspires for art that will last 500 years. And he starts to ask questions in that essay about the culture that Fra Angelico lived in, about the training of artists, about their aspirations. And you know, he ends there by saying, we could do this if we thought about our audience the way Fra Angelico thought about his audience. And Fra Angelico's ultimate audience is God. Now, there are a lot of artists, including Fujimura, who think about their audience as God, but somehow our vision of God is smaller. Our vision of the beauty of God is smaller. Our vision of making things that will contribute to and last unto eternity, in a sense, right? That Fra Angelico is not going to last unto eternity, but he is attempting to encapsulate in his time and place an eternal art. Right? And so Fujimura, at the end of that refraction, says this is what Christian artists need to do. Right? They need to have the best artistic skills and training available to them. It's not good enough just to be a nice person. Let's face it, lots of really crappy movies are made by Christians with good intentions, right? Some good ones too, but mostly crappy ones. And why is that? It's because they haven't learned how to be filmmakers, right? They think it's good enough to have good intentions and go out and make something that's going to be nice and have a good message. That's great if you're just sharing your testimony with somebody. That's not good enough if you want to be an artist, right? What Fujimura is saying is you have to have the best training. You have to find the best people to learn from. You have to take into account the entire tradition of art, the great works of Fra Angelico, of Michelangelo, of Raphael, and so on, down into the 20th century, those artists have to live in your bones. And their training has to live inside you, and then you can think about producing great art, combining enormous skill with a great devotion. So that one of the problems about our art today for Fujimura is that the artist, like most of us, lives in an ephemeral present. We're not rooted in a great tradition. We're not thinking into the future about producing something that is going to help construct a civilization that will last for centuries and centuries. As he says at one point, art suffers from a kind of amnesia, a forgetfulness of greatness. Now, I want to say just a couple words here toward the end about Fujimura's art. It's very interesting because it is not like typical traditional Christian art. He comes out of one 20th century Western tradition and a much older sort of medieval Japanese tradition. So he's very much in terms of his style, in conversation with what's called abstract art. And let me give you an example. How many people from Houston here? We got a few. How many of you have been to the Rothko Chapel in Houston, over by the University of St. Thomas? Not quite as many. Now, Sarah's older brother, I took him in there when we were down to watch us almost beat Duke in the Elite Eight game. And the next day, we should have beaten them. There was a bad charging call, I hope you'll remember. I'm still suffering from that. But I took him over here to this Rothko Chapel, and there are a series of walls that Rothko constructed. Actually, the colors have faded a bit. These look the way they were intended to look, which is quasi-purple, but the colors really just look black now. My son was sort of freaked out by this. First of all, we came out and he said, "Is that a church?" And I said, "Well, we could ask some questions about that." This is the Rothko Chapel. It didn't feel like a church to him. What Rothko was after, though, and I don't think Rothko's a Christian artist, but what Rothko was doing with abstract art was trying to address the fact that our language of beauty and our language of the sacred have become impoverished, right? They become emptied of meaning in many quarters of our life, right? So we now, the most extended place, the most regular place where we use the language of the sacred is on, we'll start doing it this Saturday, right? It's at football games. We got Hail Mary passes, we got redemption, we got touchdowns, you know, that we got, and I went to Notre Dame, we got touchdown Jesus. Right? You've got the language of the sacred, in a sense, emptied of its meaning and applied to very ordinary, insignificant things. So Rothko's responding to the fact that we don't seem to have a common, rich, public set of symbols or images. And so what do? You get rid of it all. And you create an art that on the surface for Rothko seems blank, but it's actually an attempt to point to invisible realities. Many of the abstract painters were attempting to do this, so it becomes a kind of devotional tool. Now what's interesting about this, and I sort of go back and forth on what I think about Rothko's work, but what's interesting about this is someone like Fujimura, trained in 20th century art, also, as in his Japanese tradition, there's this tradition of meditative painting in Japan that has to do with landscapes and wall scrolls, right? That has to do with nature, but nature seen in a sort of evanescent way in fog, right? Or great mountains and waterfalls with really teeny people in them that you can barely make out. You can barely make out the shapes. Way before Impressionism, there's an antecedent of it, and that's why the Impressionists were very interested in certain types of Eastern painting. But look at, just here. Here's another Rothko. Now, there's a Rothko, a very brilliant sort of Rothko. Let's go up just a little bit here. That's Fujimura. That's close, and these are horrible images. This stuff is really striking when you're right in front of it. But you say, well, what's that about? Well, it's about the color red, right, just as Rothko's is, and it's about a very vibrant use of red, right? It's also got a name to it called passion. Now, you could say, well, passion, heat, red, right? You could talk about physical passion, love, lust, passion. But I think, especially if you see Fujimura's paintings right next to one another, you quickly pick up this liturgical connotation here, right? This is blood red passion. It's sacramental passion, right? It's not just red. Well, how do you get there from, well, you sort of look at this, you look at the title, and you look at some of these others. Soliloquies, Genesis. Hovering over the abyss. Making. And here, the bringing together of divine creation and human artistic making. Fujimura very much has a kind of Tolkien view of what the artist is doing, right? That the artist is what Tolkien calls a sub-creator. Right? Someone who participates in the higher order that is divine creation. Soliloquies, Genesis. But this. Soliloquies, joy. Now, one of the things, let me go back just real quickly to this, and then I'll finish up here. One of the things about, there's a great article in the Weekly Standard a couple months back about this set of Fujimura paintings. It said that one of the things that's different about the way he layers his paint is that he's trying to present, with Rothko, it's just surface, right? What Fujimura is trying to do is to present depth, both in the physicality of the layering of paint, but also in the sense that this looks like, it almost looks like there are objects emerging in and out of clouds, right? A very blue sky and objects emerging in and out of clouds, right? Something coming in out of formlessness into form. Like the spirit hovering over the abyss and then bringing shapes out of it. But what Fujimura does here is to give the sense of depth so that your feel of it is that the painting is opening into the back and into infinity. Right? So that you're not just having the experience of vacancy, but actually being invited into a kind of space. Okay, this one. These wonderful gold leaves that he uses all over the place. And you'll notice he cites Revelation numerous times in these essays, the city of God is a city of pure gold. Right? And he loves gold. So you've got gold dancing around. Now let me find, I don't want that one. That one really looks like a Rothko. That's a Fujimura. That looks much more like a Rothko. Now this one, you got to come see this when it's over. No, that's not it. This one. Matthew 6. You got to come see this when it's over there. Because what you will see, that you can't come close to seeing here, is that inscribed in very teeny lettering, about midway in the gold there, is a lengthy passage from the Sermon on the Mount. So that there, what Fujimura is doing is taking this assumption in 20th century art that we can't say anything that's significant anymore. And so what we have to do is just to offer bland surface colors, sometimes vibrant surface colors, that might point people towards some kind of transcendence. The real problem, I think, with something like what Rothko's doing is you don't know where the heck it's pointing. Right? What's it pointing to? Whom is it pointing to? Or what is it pointing to beyond the surface? Fujimura is taking that on, adding the depth experience of infinity, and then giving us clues through the title, through the connection between the title and the color, the red in passion, through, in this case, the inscription in a very tiny way, so that only those who are looking extremely carefully can pick it up, that this is in fact a meditation on the lilies of the field. Right? This painting. So it's a remarkable attempt to use extremely contemporary, what we used to call when it was cool to say it, avant-garde methods, and yet to anchor that in a very traditional message. So this is what Fujimura is interested in. And as he says at one point, and I'll wrap up with, oh, I want to read one passage and then I'll quit. Sometimes we ask, why art? Why do we need art? Fujimura says, that's the wrong question. It's not why art, but which art? We're surrounded by it. Even the stuff we watch on TV is allegedly art. Right? It's popular art, but it's art. We're surrounded by art. This room, it's not very artistic as you look around it, but it's art, right? Architecture is art. What kind of art? Let me read this passage, which I thought was just wonderful, at 154 in the book. This is when he's talking about the Leonardo's da Vinci, the Last Supper. Leonardo da Vinci's the Last Supper. And he turns at the top of numerous places before this, but he talks about the Da Vinci Code, right? And this great fascination that everybody has with Leonardo now, and these alleged secrets that are in there. And he says at the top, the Da Vinci Code phenomena is not about conspiracy theories. It's a symptom of our cultural ills, of how easily we accept distortion and betrayal as normative and necessary. We are trained to cheapen our dialogue to fit our darkened realities. Today our money bags are full of flashy, counterfeit soundbites. And here's the passage I want you to think about. Christians must understand that this can easily happen in our worship as well as in our popular culture. It can happen in our intellectual lives. It can happen in what we do as teachers and students as well. We want God to be palatable and to fit our needs and realities so we don't have to practice a daily discipline. I venture to say that what goes on inside our worship services has a great impact upon the larger cultural condition and hence upon art. Could it be that the reason we have such a divided nation insistent on quick judgment is because the church does not fully know how to live and exercise grace? Could it be that the reason we do not have a culture full of beauty is because our worship is not beautiful? Could it be that the cause of our shortened attention span in contemporary society is because the church has not trained us to listen well? In our culture of betrayal, we are quick to impose our own view on layers of established systems. Thus, even a work of art is to be distrusted, rather than trying to understand, that is to stand under, and hence learn from, the work of art, we stand over it and dismiss it as unreadable. Or worse yet, we impose a critical ideology upon it without first allowing the work to affect us. He quotes C.S. Lewis at one point earlier in here, saying that the real task is to stop, to listen, to look, to see, to learn. What we're talking about here tonight, what Fujimori is talking about, is not just art. It's about education. Right? How many Latinists in here? Latin, a lot of you had Latin. Education, right? Educare, to be led forth. Right? You can't stay in the same place. But you want to go forth to be drawn forth by things that are beautiful, true, and good. But it takes a discipline even to figure out which those things are. My hope for you at Baylor, especially in the Honors College, is that you'll develop that discipline to see and hear and taste the beautiful things of this world and of the next. Welcome to Baylor.
Is that okay with you?
Yeah. I think what we'll do... Dennis does have somewhere he needs to be in just a few minutes, so we'll have to...